much, and I'm thrilled to be here. I actually go to a hippie college in Western Massachusetts, so thank you for putting me after two Ivy League lawyers. That's really great. But, you know, I have known John Marshall for about almost 10 years now. John was one of the people who came to New Orleans right after the storm and really dug in on the recovery. And he's known as the nicest person in New Orleans, and I thought they were going to issue a day of mourning when he announced that he was leaving. John went with the executive director of the New Orleans Redevelopment Authority from neighborhood to neighborhood. They were doing, were they nightly meetings, John? There were seven, New Orleans self-identifies as having 73 neighborhoods. And John and the executive director went to every single one of these neighborhoods after the storm. And people were so scared, so angry, and felt that government had failed them. And they did that hard face-to-face, person-to-person work. And I really believe it was that work that was sort of restored to people's confidence in government and the world. I certainly am not brave enough to do that, I'll tell you that much. And I'm a community person. So I am the executive director of an organization called Home by Hand. And we do primarily affordable housing development. We started this organization only about a year ago, and my colleagues and I think some of you had met my colleague O.G. Alexander, who came and co-presented with me one time at a meeting here in Apalachicola. But there are four of us in this little nonprofit, and prior to starting this nonprofit, the four of us were working together at Project Home Again, which was created by the chair and CEO of Barnes & Noble, Len Riggio, the founder of Barnes & Noble, who wanted to do something in New Orleans after the storm. And he decided that he wanted to build 100 homes and give them to people who had lost their homes and were at risk of not being able to return because they didn't have the resources to rebuild. And he felt that the culture of New Orleans was within the people, because our culture is about music and food and celebration and love about Indians and architecture, and all of this comes from inside the people. And so he wanted to make sure that those people were able to return. So he started this nonprofit, and I was fortunate enough to be selected to lead it. I'm telling you this because when I say we, it's sort of a blurry line. So it was the same four staff of Project Home Again, now with Home by Hand. So when I talk about our work, I'm talking about collectively all the work we did. So let's jump right in. So this is New Orleans in August of 2005. Hurricane Katrina hit, and the pressure from the water at various points in the city burst levees, and our levee system failed, and the city flooded. And so for six weeks in many places, this is what our neighborhoods look like. And this is salt water, brackish water. So our trees died, the animals were killed, anything metal corroded, and it was really a mess. And 80% of the city, roughly 80% of our residential stock was under water. And when the water finally went down, this is sort of what we were left with. So it was a huge undertaking. When it got cleaned up, this is what we were left with. A lot of folks didn't come back. Our population went from 450,000 down to what, John, like 20,000-40,000, because there was a mandatory evacuation, and then we had to return from there. So in that short period of time, just a year or so, this is what started to happen with the homes that people did not return to. So this is the city of New Orleans, French Quarter. is down here. The city of New Orleans actually is all here and then goes all the way out. And if any of you have been to the Vietnamese neighborhood in New Orleans, it's way out there. And then this is the lower Ninth Ward that received sustained terrible damage. The neighborhood we work in is Gentilly. And New Orleans is somewhat of a bowl, as we all found out. And Gentilly is in one of the lowest areas of the bowl. So Gentilly, most of Gentilly is below sea level. And it was made into sort of dry earth through engineering and pumping. There is a ridge, though, a highland ridge, you know, 11 feet, that runs through Gentilly. So there is some historic housing in Gentilly because it wasn't really pumped dry until after the storms in 1928. So most of the housing in Gentilly is post-World War II housing, but there is some housing in Gentilly that was built by California craftsmen who were brought in from California to build housing. And the California craftsman style is actually elevated. So on this ridge, these elevated homes were very appropriate for our environment. After the storm, this nonprofit was formed, and we went out and talked to the community about what they would like to see. The housing stock was really wiped out in the neighborhood where we were going to redevelop. And they said they wanted to see something in the craftsman style. So we purchased a piece of land. Len Riggio, the Barnes & Noble chair, purchased a piece of land. And this is the parcel here that we could fit 20 homes on. And we came up with a little two-bedroom model, a three-bedroom, and a four-bedroom model, elevated above the base flood elevation, so insurance rates would be lower for the homeowners, and built these houses. This was incredibly expensive. This is a per-unit cost. We purchased vacant land that had never been developed. It had no gray infrastructure at all. So the cost per lot was $27,500. The construction, you saw all the different roof angles and stairs and elevation and covered parking. So those houses cost about $250,000. The architects in the room, if you cover your ears at this point, we hired an architectural firm, and very young people, a lot of experimentation, and there was a lot of swirling around, and then our soft costs were also very high. So this is actually, I was not brought on board until they were about midway through this. So this is what I came into, and it was great because your first project's always going to be your most expensive. You're going to make a whole bunch of mistakes, a whole bunch of things are going to go wrong. So this is the per unit cost for the first 20 houses. After we did those first 20 houses on that one lot, we built the houses, and then we offered them for free to low-income families, families earning less than 80% of AMI, who had owned homes. My husband, Calvin Barker.
I'm sorry.
Area median income. So by federal law, the definition of low income is a household that earns less than 80% of the area median income, AMI. And so in the first round of houses, all of the families who we served were earning less than 80% of the area median income. They had owned homes in New Orleans prior to the storm and still owned the property. And they were willing to trade into us their damaged property in exchange for a new home. And we called this our swapping program, and this achieved a couple things. First of all, it got people into a house real quick. Secondly, we weren't building on some piece of land that somebody owned, so we were not custom builders, which is somewhere we really didn't want to go. The third thing was, we were able to cluster all of these families on this one lot at a time when, you know, a lot of our city was still dark. Population, even 11 years, 12 years later, still hasn't reached the pre-Katrina population. So people wanted to be together next to neighbors that had lights on. So this helped us accomplish that. But also what it did was, it gave us new land to develop. So after we traded in the, after they made the swap, we looked at their lot and said, is this in a neighborhood that's coming back? So this lot was actually a home that was demolished by the storm, by the flood, and we rebuilt on that lot. The difference, of course, you can see, is this house is only slightly elevated. This is the pre-Katrina elevation. Post-Katrina, this is the type of elevation. So architecturally, this was a real challenge for us, and also it adds a lot of expense. But we were able to do scattered site infill housing. So that's what this is, scattered site infill housing. So in this case, this was a house, I'm sorry, you can't really see it, but there's a house back there that was storm damaged, foundation was cracked, the house was almost split in half. We demolished it and then put a new infill house on it. And so it's another instance and a fine instance. And then we did another round, and in this one we actually made them a little bigger because we were dealing with bigger lots, added screen porches. And so then this is what it looked like this time. The agency that John had been working for had acquired a lot of vacant land after the storm. And they began selling us those lots for $1,500, which was basically the closing cost, what it costs to transfer the lot from the New Orleans Redevelopment Authority to our nonprofit. We were able to bring our construction costs way down, and we signed a fixed price contract, which we had not done in the prior round. The architect, we show it as zero, but really the architect is the fee is in this cost because we asked the contractor to actually take over the relationship with the architect. And so the architect and the contractor were in the same room designing the building together, which avoided all of that. The architect does a beautiful design, spends a lot of time on it. The contractor takes a look at it and says, oh no, I can't build that. And certainly not for So, but this architect, it wasn't a shotgun marriage. The architect and the builder had worked together before and on our earlier round, and they came together. And so, and then the architect was paid for each house that was produced. So the architect took a risk in getting involved with the project, but there was a flat fee that the architect earned for each house that was produced. And the architect ended up doing very, very well. But for us, it really worked. And for the contractor, it really worked. Our legal, we were able to reduce. And then we added landscaping. What often happens with, you saw how high our houses are elevated. And without landscaping around the bottom, they looked horrible. Awful, in fact. And in the nonprofit world, when you're doing a community a project, the first thing to go from the budget is the landscaping. You know, landscaping is quite a, you know, that, if there's any money at the end of your project, then you have a landscaping budget. But, yeah, but we felt that it was really important, and the community said to us too, so we included landscaping. So we were able to reduce the cost per home by about $100,000. Our neighborhood, as I mentioned, there is this historic section within the neighborhood, and it is on the national, it's a registered historic district. And those are beautiful craftsman style houses. But the bulk of the neighborhood is really a post-World War II neighborhood. And after we had built about 200, you know, craftsman style, three-bedroom, two-bathroom houses, and all the other nonprofits were pretty much doing the same thing, we decided that we wanted to try something different and look to another architectural style within our neighborhood and come up with something new and fresh. And also, around the same time, we were transitioning from Project Home Again to Home by Hand, and Lambrigio, our sponsor, Project Home Again, really wanted to make a break and signal that this was, one was not the other. So we were building one of those houses that you saw on the earlier slides one day, and next door, there was this building, a single family home. The windows were boarded, the roof had big holes in it, the storm water had been up to these rafters and it sat underwater, but it had a terrazzo floor and these brick walls. And I said to my colleague OG, who some of you met, you know, what's going on with that building next door, that house next door? And he said, oh, Nora's going to tear it down for us so we can build a new house. And I said, oh, it's slab on grade. I know we, you know, it's really bad for this climate. And stuff, but let's go in. So we pulled away some plywood and we climbed in through a window. And sure enough, there was this beautiful terrazzo floor underneath all the mud. And we saw these brick buildings, the Roman bricks. And it's okay. And all the windows were smashed out and everything. But we decided that we were going to, that this was worth saving. So we did a historic rehab of this house. A lot of times people like to battle with the mid-century modern and get those nice Victorian doors with the big oval in the front. We actually embraced our inner mid-century modern, which for me was really easy because I grew up with all this stuff. This is what was across the street. So, and we call this eclectic, these slides the eclectic. This is all on one street. All of these different styles. And all of these that are slab on grade were pre-existing homes that were either rebuilt or remodeled after the storm. And so this is what we came up with, a sort of modern version. And here's a good example. This is without the landscaping. Now we have landscaping in, and you can barely see this bottom, but this is a three-bedroom, two-bathroom house that we built. The night shots are always so lovely. We had a great party there. And this is a stormwater retention garden. All the water comes off the roof into a French drain, all the way under and into that. We can capture about 1,000 gallons of rainwater. This is our our floor plan. I'm sorry, that's so small. This is our current development project. And what we show here, that was not in the other ones, is the developer's fee. So we're still getting our land inexpensively. That was a terrific program we were able to work out with Laura. Put $1,000 in for landscaping. We have a fixed price construction. Again, it's design build, so the architecture fee is within the construction. We've been able to routinize our legal work. The city requires us to meet Energy Star standards. We always push back a little bit on this because after having built 200 houses at all the various energy standards, we feel like we can build a really good house without coming up having to meet somebody else's requirements. In the past, what we were able to do was build four or five of the same model, have them all tested, and then get the city to basically give us a waiver so we didn't have to keep retesting the same house over and over and over again. We all want to build energy efficient housing, but I think that in some cases the it's become a bit of a racket as far as the testing of them. Static maintenance, this is what it costs you to sort of hold on to it, Calvin.
How many square feet is that house so you can get
this
an idea?
Is a little over 1,300. It's probably 1,350, which is sort of standard for New Orleans affordable housing. We now, when Len Riggio was our sponsor, he provided us with a 0% interest construction loan that we would pay back when we sold the house. Now we actually pay construction interest. We have two construction loans, one from John's former agency, the New Orleans Redevelopment Authority, at 2%, and one from Capital One at 1%, and we're able to get that low interest rate because of the Community Reinvestment Act, CRA, you'll hear, which requires banks to make loans in neighborhoods where they take deposits. So wherever a bank has a physical presence, an ATM machine, a bank building, by federal law, they must make loans in that same area. It's part of the anti-redlining. And so nonprofits...
And also they get extra credit if they make a loan for an affordable housing unit. So that's why it's not just the area, it's the affordability.
Right.
Both of those... There would be banks who would be interested in these projects here in Appalachia.
Right. And because we are able, that's right. And so there, the banks are very interested. Is it a low-income census tract? Are you serving a low-income family? Is this an organization that serves low-income people in general? And if you can check any of those boxes, that bank is going to be very interested in doing business with you because they earn credits, they earn points, essentially, for doing business, for checking those boxes. And when the banks are reviewed every few years, they have a CRA review, and the CRA examiner comes and looks at them, and are they... adhering to this federal requirement. And so the other thing is, every year, and I just sent my email last night, we asked Capital One for a grant to support our operations. And for the last 3 years, they've given us a $15,000 grant to help support our nonprofit, which is very helpful. Miscellaneous and then this developer's fee. So, and this is probably a little more information than you need, but if you're going to do housing, affordable housing development in Apalachicola, especially the sort of infill, nonprofit-run community development model, the nonprofit organization has to be able to pay its staff. And the way that nonprofits pay their staff, unless there is huge philanthropy, as in the case of when we were sponsored by the chairman of Barnes & Noble, he paid our costs. He paid our overhead. And so we did not fundraise outside of that. We didn't want to compete with other groups that didn't have a billionaire sponsor underwriting their costs. But now he is gone, and we have to support ourselves. So our total operating costs are about $600,000 every year. We have four staff people. And
so are you now selling these houses?
So we are. So the first 100, Len Riggio and through his family gifted. The next 100, we actually were selling them for him because we were able to convince him that there was a need for more affordable housing, and that people would buy homes, and they did. And then he left town. He had been there for 10 years, which is pretty much longer than any other philanthropy. And I say, go out there and buy those Barnes and Noble, because it's really, he's an amazing person and extraordinarily philanthropic. And this was his own money, not, this was not Barnes and Noble corporate money. This was Len Riggio family, the money that he made. And the money that he made, because his dad was a cab driver, so it's really the money he made. Our business model, if you will, as a nonprofit, is to build between 20 and 22 houses a year. So start construction on 2 houses per month, finish them in 4 weeks, and collect roughly a $20,000 developer fee on each home. Typically, what you'll see is developer fees for nonprofits for home ownership is about 10% of the total development cost. So ours is in line with the industry standard. If we are able to do 20 homes, that's $400,000, and then we fundraise to for that balance, that $200,000, and that's how nonprofits support themselves if they're doing affordable housing development. So now you can all go out and be a nonprofit. You know all there is that you need to know. And this is how we financed this deal. The Capital One loan at 1%, the Nora loan at 2%, and then here's the rub, okay? So whenever you're working in a low-income community where property values are depressed, typically it will cost you more to build the home than the house will appraise for after it's constructed, okay? So in our case, roughly the numbers are, it costs us around $200,000 all in, developer, everything, to build the house. But that house will only appraise at $175,000. And if you wondered why none of the big developers were in these low-end communities building houses, that is why. You cannot make money doing this work. There is an appraisal gap, is what we call it, and that gap has to be filled with some form of subsidy. We like to call it paper. There are all sorts of fancy names for it, too. Patient capital. Equity.
Do you see the appraisal gap narrowing as you build more and more homes?
Great question. So those first houses that we showed you, the big ones, the four-bedroom, we built those maybe about 7-8 years ago. The biggest house we built appraised at $145,000, and we were so happy we couldn't believe that it appraised that high, because the median home value in the more working class neighborhoods of New Orleans had been around $90,000 to maybe $110,000 before the storm. So after the storm, nobody knew what anything was going to appraise at. And our appraisals had been coming in at 125, 135, so on and so forth. 200 houses later in this neighborhood, plus all of the reinvestment by homeowners who decided to stay and use the money they got from Congress to the state, to the city, to them, to rebuild their homes, we're seeing property values rise. Also, there's demand for housing in New Orleans because we have a housing shortage because we lost 80% of our housing stock. So, yes, and the idea, I mean, ours has been, really up to this point, a market-building strategy. We wanted to build the housing market in this neighborhood because whenever there's such a huge gap, I mean, remember, that those first houses cost us $300,000 each to build. They weren't even worth half of what we built them for. So that is, talk about unsustainable. That is unsustainable. There aren't enough government dollars.
It is something that you could hope to eventually grow out of if you make
Yes, and so, right, very much so. I mean, you want it to be a healthy market. And a healthy market is one where you can make the numbers work. And then, a nonprofit, would move on. And actually, we're thinking about doing it because as property values are rising now in some areas where we build quite rapidly, we're concerned more now about preserving affordability And the problem with a lot of these for sale houses is that they do have, as Craig knows, you know, time limited affordability periods. But after you hit that year, be it year 5 or 15 or 40 or whatever, those restrictions evaporate and the house can be sold on for full market value. And quite often at that point, if your market building strategy has worked, is no longer affordable to a low-income family. So what we're actually experimenting now on the west side of Gentilly is with a community land trust model, because property values, we no longer have an affordable, we no longer have an appraisal gap on that side of town, on that side of our neighborhood. Property values are way high, and the for-profit developers have come into the neighborhood and are buying land and are able to build a home and make $40,000 on it, which is what a developer pretty much wants to do when they build a single-family home, at least in New Orleans, because a lot of them are very small concerns, maybe father, son, you know, a couple people, and they want to do 4 or 5 or 6 of them a year and make those sort of profit margins. So in those neighborhoods where Nora still owns land, we thorn in their side. Now, we've been advocating for the city agency to use those last remaining pieces of land that they have for permanently affordable housing. And really, in the home ownership world, the only way you can have permanent affordability and home ownership, and give the homeowner the opportunity to gain some equity on their investment, is through the shared equity model in which mechanisms are put in place to limit the amount of profit, essentially, or equity the homeowner can take when they sell their property, when they sell their thing. And there are a million ways that this is done, and but that's the basic notion, that at the end, the land is owned by a community land trust, the homeowner owns the leasehold improvement, and when that property is sold, the amount of money they can take from the deal is restricted, and this keeps it affordable for the next family. So in this case, our appraisal gap is filled by that $25,000 grant from the New Orleans Redevelopment Authority. But these are very hard dollars for government to come up with, and very, very, very few sources of this money. Home dollars, which maybe some of you have heard of, Calvin, Appalachian Pole wouldn't qualify for home dollars.
They could. The state of Florida gets home funding, which it then allocates something to a home small cities program. So I don't know whether Apalachicola has ever received it, but you guys can make an application to the state of Florida. There's a thing called, most cities that get it are over 60 or 70,000 people that are what's called entitlement. There's also the Community Development Block Grant Program that will be a state, and I'm pretty sure that you've got something from that, from the state, so those are sources.
To rebuild some mobile homes recently.
That's an interesting news. And Carol, are you going to get to the soft second mortgage program that you use, which is another way that you can subsidize the individual and not just the property?
Yeah, let me stay on the developer side and then I'll move over to that side. So the problem with both home and CDBG, the Community Development Block Grant, CDBG, which I always thought was that cross called in the lower, but it's not, is that the people who are served by these programs must be at 80% or less of area median income. And when you're talking about home ownership programs, that's very difficult because those incomes in most places are pretty low, really low. And I'm sorry I didn't pull the numbers for Apalachicola, but they're low, trust me. And so it's very hard for a household at that low income to maintain a home ownership situation in many cases. So recently, About a year ago, after, you know, these 200 houses and trying to sell them and realizing that we were able to shrink this appraisal gap, but the gap still existed, we sort of think, like, how else can we fill this gap? You know, Nora can only come up with so much money. There was the a program called Neighborhood Stabilization Program that was part of the Obama's recovery.
Partly it was after the financial crisis, but it was the foreclosure crisis. It was known as NSP by most people. But you got money if you were in an area where there were a bunch of foreclosures. I don't know whether Appalachian Cola ever got any assistance.
So that was a national program, but then that money ended, and we had been using that money to fill. So when all of a sudden it became clear that it's hard to find money out there, there must be money, because most Americans live in single-family housing. Most affordable housing is one and two family housing, the private market. You know, there must be money out there to close this appraisal gap. And I looked all over, and there wasn't. In fact, the only place where there really was money was in the rural areas, and Apalachicola qualifies, through the Department of Agriculture. And there is a Section 502 program, I believe, that I don't really know. I went to a few conferences, I learned it, and now I've forgotten. But it actually provides exactly what you need if you're an affordable housing developer. It provides grant money for the nonprofit developer to do the work. It provides construction financing to do the construction. And it provides the mortgage for the homeowner. So it's really a terrific program because it, you know, takes care of all of the needs in the sort of development process. Cities over 25,000 residents are not eligible for that money. So we couldn't use it. So I've been around in the nonprofit world for a while, and I was able to start talking to people across the country who I worked with years ago, who had ascended to much more important positions than I will ever achieve. And we called a meeting in New Orleans of these leaders of these national housing and community development organizations to talk about this problem of the appraisal gap. And after several months of sort of working together and meeting, and we decided that what was needed was in fact a new program. And so we have now proposed the creation of a tax credit for the rehabilitation or new construction of 1 to 4 family homes in distressed areas, in areas where the cost to build or renovate still exceeds what a house can be sold for. So exactly this appraisal gap program. There is no other program in the United States at this point, federal program, that is specifically designed to do this. And we have some registered lobbyists now. We've gotten some funding from some of the big national foundations to help propel this effort. And we're doing the slow and hard work of coalition building, and it looks now like we may have a sponsor for a bill. Interestingly, when I had this idea and started bringing people together around it, it turns out that one of the architects of the low-income housing tax credit, who's a friend and former colleague, had actually come up with a similar idea back in 2003 and had gotten a bill onto the floor of the House in 2005, right before the mortgage crisis. And it all sort of fell apart. But they had gotten 304 sponsors in the House and 49 or something like that in the Senate. So there's really bipartisan support for this sort of thing. And interestingly, whenever you have talking about what I've been told because I'm not an expert in this at all. But in order to do any sort of tax credit bill, it actually has to happen during tax reform. So it's very timely that this is occurring now. The great thing about tax credits is that they are under the, they are not out of HUD. They're under the Department of Treasury. So it's not, you know, HUD is constantly getting slashed and beaten and, you know, kicked around. And so this would not be that there. It would be the warm embrace of the U.S. Department of Treasury. Therefore, it might be around for a while longer. So so this is what we're working on, because really, unless we can find a source for this sort of patron capital to make these things happen, we will see these wonderful homes in neighborhoods that would be so vibrant sit there because they have effectively been redlined by our housing policies. And so we're really hoping that this, and if you want any more information, I believe, let's see what Andy did. So let me just, just quickly. So this is how it would work. This would be a rehab. So let's say someone bought an old shotgun in bad condition, but in a nice location, $65,000. And this isn't new construction. The cost of the renovation is about $120,000, and then there's another $10,000 in soft costs. So the total development cost is this $195,000, but when you go out and get it appraised, it only appraises for $150,000, so you have this gap of $45,000. This is your appraisal gap. It's cost you $45,000 more to do this project than you're going to bring back in. The formula for this proposed neighborhood homes tax credit grant would be the total development cost, this $195,000, times 35% is $68,250. So this project would be eligible for up to that amount of money to close the appraisal gap. It only needs 45, so it would qualify. And so this is how that would work. And for a place like Apalachicola, this would be tremendous. So here's my information. If you want to learn more about the tax credit, this is the website for the tax credit. Into disrepair and who want to rehab. And so it's a little bit more complex because they would have to get a construction loan, do the rehab, have an appraisal done, and figure out what the gap is, and then the tax credit can cover the gap. But the sponsoring agency, the idea is that you have these sponsoring agencies that sort of guide the local nonprofits or cities, whatever, through this process. Yes?
What happened to the factor about, so it only applied to people who own homes?
So that was it just, that was when Len Riggio crafted his program in New Orleans. It was specifically a recovery program, a post-Katrina recovery program. So he wanted to make sure that people who owned their homes prior to the storm were able to come back from Dallas or Atlanta or wherever they were. It was called the diaspora, the Katrina diaspora, and come back to the city of New Orleans. So that was for his particular philanthropic program. The interesting thing about this program is this program would be, because it's a home ownership program, we've actually designed it to serve people up to 140% of their median income, so a little bit higher because it is home ownership, and we want to promote income diversity in some of these lower income neighborhoods. The neighborhood would have to qualify for this money, and so it'd be on a census tract by census tract basis. And so a census tract would have to have a poverty rate of greater than 20%. The median home values would have to be less than the very wide median home value. And the income, the median income would have to be less. So the idea that the money would be directed toward neighborhoods that have some poverty and where house prices are somewhat depressed. And when we did a national mapping of these criteria, when we overlaid these criteria on all the census tracts in the United States, 22% of all the census tracts in the United States would qualify to participate in this program. But there is no prior homeownership in the new tax credit. That was strictly something that Len Riggio came up with post-Katrina.
This is all proposed.
This is proposed. John?
Two quick questions about sort of, I guess, adjuncts or add-ons to people who are nonprofits here do this type of work. So with respect to job training and getting people involved in rehab activities, and then the other thing I think you have some experience with in New Orleans is doing work ahead of time to help make sure they're qualified for homeownership programs, qualified homeowners, people who are credit ready. Because that's still an issue, isn't it, in order to get people in their homes to make sure that they've rehabilitated their credit if they needed to, because they've gone through whatever difficulties they have financially. Are those two things sort of that one is that kind of program educating people in construction trade possible from a cost perspective, and then what the towns can do ahead of time to get communities ready so that people can buy these homes or be eligible to buy them?
Right. So those are both great questions. So on the sort of workforce, the first nonprofit housing organization I ever led, 30-something years ago in Brooklyn, was called the East New York Urban Youth Corps. And the nonprofit that had sort of spawned this new organization that I led, their vision was to train young people on housing rehabilitation by having them do these houses, so on and so forth. What everybody pretty much finds out and tries to do something like that is the first thing you have to learn how to do is build a house. So, and then start adding on to. So when Len Riggio started this program before I came, there were people, they had cisterns and wind modeling and the union, and there were all these things sort of piled onto the back of this little tiny housing program. And, at first we had to sort of clear it all out, figure out how to build a house, then figure out how to build a house at a good price. Since then, we've been adding things on. So you'll see the first thing we added on was solar panels. Then we added on home ownership, the homeowners actually participating in the development. Most recently, we partnered with a workforce, a youth workforce training program, and now they participate in the building. So I think that, you know, on paper, you can just spin the most beautiful thing and make it all things to all people. I think the important thing is to strip it all down, figure out how to do it, and then slowly and incrementally add on these different pieces, because it's just so easy to fail at this stuff. And the minute you fail, like the finger is pointed and see, I told you, and it's a scam, and it was a thing, and a debacle, and, you know, on and on and on and on and on. And it's only usually because people were too ambitious to begin with. So I highly support them. My advice to anybody is just add it, figure out what you're doing, then add another element and another element and another element. Home ownership training is so important. So everyone who applies to our program, we call it a homesteading program, a self-help housing program, because all of our homeowners now in these funky modern houses are required to spend 100 hours working on the home. And this helps us control, too, who the buyer is going to be without discriminating. What we found was if we built a beautiful house and put a sign on the front, and all the person had to do was be below 120% of AMI, it was working really, really, really well for young, single kids in their first job out of college who were technically low income, but who had wealthy families. And some of them would show up at the closing table with their mommies, like stroking out the down payment check. And as much as we welcome, you know, we want a diverse neighborhood, and you know, we want young people to come to our neighborhood, these are not the programs that our heavily subsidized program is not intended for people from high wealth families. So now we, in our own minds, we had to wrap our heads around, wow, what is a low income, you have low income, two low income people, but one is from a high wealth family and one is from a low wealth family. And if you put that sign out front, that high wealth family person is going to be able to snatch that house up, and that low wealth family person is never going to.
Since John spent so much time on the 8th Street shotguns, why do you think your model of two-owner rentals would work there? I mean, how did you come up with that?
Gosh, that was a little year ago. I can't even remember. I think that, well, a couple things. What I heard from the community was absentee landlordism is a problem here. And as John said, the sort of gold standard for rental housing is either having an on-site manager or a homeowner. So clearly for a little four-unit project, you're not going to have an on-site manager. So I thought that the sort of homeowner, owner-occupant, with the rental unit was a good model because it made the deal more doable. This is from a numbers perspective, it did give you that on-site owner and that owner's presence. And the units were relatively small, so it would be just by sheer fact that it's a small unit, an affordable unit, because you can only charge so much for a one-bedroom unit. So you kind of, for us, it provided a homeownership opportunity, the gold standard around rentals, around the thing, and the opportunity to create two low-income rental units. With our homeowners, people come to us, they apply for a home now. So we don't put the sign up. They apply for a home. We do a credit, we send them to one of the organizations, there are 11 in New Orleans that are certified by HUD to do homeowner counseling, and I know you have an organization here that does that. They do full credit assessment, figure out what repair they may have to do to their credit. We get send them to some of our lenders. We have four lenders that we tend to work with. They get pre-qualified for a loan. Once they're pre-qualified for a loan, we sign a construction contract with them. and that contract is good for 6 months. We build the house in 4 months, and then we're able to close on the house. And I apologize to the realtors in the room. We don't have any realtor leads, which is great because that makes it even more affordable. The day that house is done, the homeowner moves into it. And because it's a program as opposed to just a sale out there in the world, we're able to, you know, work with families and help them get into home ownership as opposed to putting it out there and having these families that need all this work compete with someone who doesn't. One thing I want to say, and you know, this happened, and it's just changed the whole world of home mortgages. Until last April, I believe it was, if you had student debt and your debt was deferred, it did not count toward the debt load that a mortgage lender would look at. Now, even if your student debt is deferred, 1% of that has to be calculated toward your monthly debt. So, if you have a $40,000 student loan, even if it's deferred, the bank now has to count $400 of that per month as like a loan payment. And this has absolutely killed the chances of people from low-wealth families who we all went out and told, get an education, you know, here's a loan, sign on the line, get education, education, education. And some people now, well, particularly teachers, we all like to talk about funding teachers. All these teachers, all that education they're required to get, and then the low salaries they have. We had a young teacher come into our office the other day to very interesting, one of our houses, met the income requirements, lived in the, you know, rented in the neighborhood, wanted to buy the house nearby, walked so she could walk to her school in the morning. She has $120,000 in student debt. She will never in her lifetime be able to get a mortgage on a home. All we have to hope is she marries well, because she's never going to be able to. So knowing, you know, we know so many things, but we don't know enough about mortgages, and the rules have changed, and it's made it even harder for low-income families. So they call it financial literacy training now, and I think it should happen in the high schools.
Thank you.